Welcome, everyone. Episode 438 of the NBA podcast. I'm Brian Toporek, and today we're about halfway through the conference finals, a little less than halfway, so we're going to catch up on both the East and the West. We also had a lot of coaching news this week, so we'll talk about the new hires for the Indiana Pacers, the Dallas Mavericks, and while nothing is totally official yet, the Portland Trail Blazers as well. Before we get into that, a reminder that you can follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bio, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some five-star reviews. We're being hosted by Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. Joining me today is someone for whom congratulations are apparently in order for something-something, soccer, football, whatever. Morten Jensen, how's it going?
It's going well. Yeah, we beat Wales 4-0, so we are going to go into the quarterfinals.
Hooray! I'm very excited for you, I guess.
Yeah, you should be.
Okay, yeah. I would be lying if I said I've been paying much attention to this tournament, but no, genuinely very, very happy for the fine people of Denmark, I hope. Who do you play? Do you know who you play in the quarters yet?
No, I don't think so yet. I think that game is still up for grabs. I believe it could be Sweden, in which case it would be blood war. But what's interesting here is we lost our best player, obviously, Christian Eriksen, is it called a heart attack when it's like just when the heart just stops, or is it called something else? A cardiac arrest?
Yeah, correct. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay. And this team has just rallied. Like, this is probably the closest I've seen the entire nation, like, togetherness, like, the togetherness of the nation since as long as I can remember. We won the European Championship in 1992, but I was 6 years old, so I don't remember that. Mm. But this is something that I've never seen before. This entire nation is just, like, behind this squad. It's very intoxicating.
Oh, okay. Well, that's... I'm genuinely rooting for you guys, then.
Appreciate it.
And speaking of teams that rallied, Mort, let's start with the Western Conference Finals, because those are tonight. Last time we recorded, the Clippers were once again in a 2-0 hole, like they have been throughout the entire playoffs. And once again, they come back in Game 3 and make it a series. They win 106-92. Chris Paul did return in this game, but both he and Devin Booker had miserable shooting nights. They combined to go 10 of 40 from the field. Meanwhile, Paul George overcomes the blown two free throws at the end of Game 2. Didn't have a super efficient night, but 27 points, 15 rebounds, 8 assists. Reggie Jackson continues to be spectacular. The Suns were cutting the lead down. I think they got it down to 6 in the middle of the fourth quarter. And all Twitter started to get nervous, like, Clippers? And then Reggie Jackson reeled off, I think, 5 straight points to at least give them some breathing room.
But it's been so good.
I want to start with Zubac, actually, because we saw this in the Jazz series, where they started small in Game 1, went big in Game 2, and then went small, back down small the rest of the series. This series, I believe they started small again, went big in Game 2, and now have stayed big. I guess they tweaked the lineup a little bit because Marcus Morris did not start in Game 3. It was Mann and Beverly in the backcourt, as well as Reggie Jackson. But Zubac has been starting the last two games of this series. He actually led the team in free throw attempts with 10, but 15 points, 16 rebounds. He's been a huge difference maker so far for the Clippers. Yeah. Do you think he can keep it up?
I don't know. I think the Suns are very good at adapting. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't be shocked if they kind of figure him out, you know, and whatever that means. If that means trying to get him on a switch and then just burn him, if that means dropping the ball down to DeAndre and just basically telling him go and beat on his ass very early and try to get two fouls on him.
Yeah,
I really don't know what the counter is, but they have some options. And look, I agree with you. Zubac has been very, very steady, and he's been very, very good. He's been winning those minutes. But he is still the same player as always, which means he's a bit slow-footed. So if you catch him off guard any given night, you know, you can probably make him somewhat irrelevant. That said, if you don't do that, then it's his game. Then he's able to rebound. He's able to get putbacks. He's able to get up for layups and dunks. And he can even put in like the 15-foot shot, even though he doesn't utilize that option a lot. But he's got it in his bag if he needs to. So it's going to be interesting to see whether or not he can sustain the level of play that he does right now. I mean, to me, it all boils down to Devin Booker. Like, Booker is the guy who can draw fouls on bigs. He's the guy who can really get into the teeth of defense at consistently and try to make plays. So if he takes over and goes, you know what, Subac has been a problem for us all series, let me just go at him. Mm-hmm. I think that would paint a different picture. But we'll see. I mean, the mask seems to be bothering him a little bit. Maybe that's just my pseudo-analysis because, like, he put on the mask and then he started shooting poorly. Maybe that's that. I don't know. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, he, after the game, he said it wasn't the reason that he shot poorly. He just said he had an off night. Okay. So, but I mean, you know, what is he going to say? Like, oh, yeah, the mask is totally the only reason. Like,
right, right. You
know, he wasn't.
I didn't hear that quote.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I mean, also, you know, after he has a 40-point triple-double in game one, and then the Clippers move Pat Bev into the starting lineup for the next two games, and Pat Bev, you know, you're still not going to, like, completely, that's what we've been saying about all of these star players, you're not going to shut these guys down completely, but I don't think it's a coincidence that he's had two off-shooting nights in a row. So how do you think Booker, like, what does he need to do and what do the Suns need to do to solve Booker's Pat Bev problem?
Move him a little bit more off the ball. I think that's the play. Make sure that he's catching the ball in rhythm, maybe give him a little bit more shots from outside, maybe just make sure that he's cutting instead of being on the ball. Now with Chris Paul back, I think that gives him a rather unique opportunity to do so, because now he doesn't have to command the ball as much, he won't have to initiate, play make, all those things. Now he can run around in semicircles. Look, he's wearing a mask. Do as Rip Hamilton did. Why not? Just move around in semicircles, floppy action all the game, catch and shoot, both from mid-range and from three. Why not? I think that's probably the way you do it, because Beverly is really, really tough on ball, but I think you can figure him out off ball.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the other thing that at least was a notable storyline from game three is that Cameron Payne played only 4 minutes, I believe. He left with a sprained ankle. He is, from what I saw, he was listed as probable on the injury report. So it sounds like he should be good to go tonight. But, you know, considering how well he played, especially in game two when he led the team with 29 points, 9 assists, you know, you have Chris Paul back, so you don't need to lean on him as much. But having him back in the lineup can at least keep that second unit humming a bit more efficiently. How big do you think the loss of Payne was in game three? And, you know, just what's your read on this series moving forward now that, in theory, we've got a pretty much fully healthy Suns team? We still have no idea if or when Kawhi Leonard is returning.
Right. I mean, look, Cameron Payne has been good all throughout the playoffs, so that's a substantial loss in game three when he only played 4 minutes. And look, let's hope the ankle is doing well, let's hope that he's back, let's hope that he's doing what he needs to be doing. I mean, this is a guy who can come in, like you said, facilitate, score, lead the second unit. I mean, what was he averaging before game three? I think it was 20-9 over the course of the series. Like 20-9, that was the campaign experience. So yeah, he needs to come in every single moment, just be aggressive off the bench. He can do so. I think that changes the entire structure of the series dramatically, because who do you have on LA that can really come in off the bench and guard him? Like, mm-hmm. Some people will say Rondo, where I'll go, no. That's the perception of Rondo seems to be better than Rondo himself.
Yeah.
So I think he is extremely important for their bench, for their depth. I mean, I honestly wonder if he'd been fully healthy all the way through, if nothing had bothered him, if he could have sort of overcome the shooting prowess, the shooting slumps of Booker and Paul in game three. Like,
yeah.
Maybe he starts becoming aggressive. Maybe he starts hitting threes. Maybe he gets in and like draws contact and gets to the line. Maybe he does something, you know? He's becoming that type of player who can do all these different things. My God. By the way, side note, Brian, and we need to talk about this in a couple of months, or next month, rather. He is going to get paid mm-hmm. because the point guard market is not great.
Him and Reggie Jackson, both.
Him and Reggie Jackson, but I mean, this is like we could be looking at a Cameron Payne who's going to be averaging, you know, $15-16 million over the foreseeable future. I wouldn't be shocked if a team did that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's another thing that we can, especially once the playoffs are over, we can look back, but I don't think it's a coincidence that really three of the four teams left have really hit on some of their bargain signings, whether it's
yeah.
the Suns with Payne, the Clippers with Jackson and Batum in particular, and then the Bucks with Bryn Forbes and Bobby Portis.
Right.
Like, it's just really hard to build a good team in the NBA, but if you get one or two legit rotation players on a minimum contract or a near minimum contract mm-hmm. and they make an impact, particularly in the playoffs, it just gives you, like, that is the edge between good and great or great and elite. And I think, you know, it's a kudos to both Payne and Jackson in this series in particular that they've been able to make the impact that they have despite playing on, I think both are on minimum deals, if I remember correctly.
I think you're right. I don't have them from, if it's not minimum deals, it's close to it.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I'm with you, though, in terms of his absence in Game 3. Like, that's in part why I brought it up, because I do wonder, even though you get 10 of 40 from Booker and Paul, like, again, you were within 6 points in the fourth quarter, and there just wasn't that same guy. Like, Payne had been so good helping to run the first unit, he could have done that in the second unit. Like, instead, you're having to rely on, you know, Torrey Craig and Etuan Moore. Like, they don't have another real point guard in the rotation other than Paul and Payne. Like, Booker is going to take a lot of the playmaking duty as well. So just having him back in the fold, assuming he's healthy, should be a big lift for the Suns in Game 4. Right. Let me double check. So I know the series right now, the Suns are still heavily favored. They're a -450 at FanDuel Sportsbook. Actually, the Clippers are favored in Game 4, though. They are -1. So who would you take more moving forward in this series, Suns or Clippers?
I'm still going Suns.
Yeah. I lean that way, too, but I am just... I do want to talk about the Clippers for a minute because I think
yeah.
what they've done, especially in the absence of Kawhi, like as soon as he went down between Games 4 and 5 of that Jazz series, you and I were both just like, nope. Dead and buried, they're gone, no way. They come back and win those two games. I mean, it's a testament to them, to Ty Lue, who has been phenomenal in these playoffs. I think he's making a lot of teams regret not hiring him in this past coaching cycle. That includes the Sixers.
Yeah.
Go down 2-0 against the Suns team, you know, and really feel like, especially how Game 2 ended. Like, that could have been the gut punch that was just like, we cannot come back from this. We should have stolen that game. That was our opportunity. Right. We blew it. You know, they go out to a nice lead, and then the Suns come charging back in the fourth. They could have crumbled under that pressure. They didn't. I'm so impressed with the resilience of this team, especially yeah. in the wake of their collapse last year against Denver. Like, they're the first team, apparently, to ever come back from 2-0 deficits in the playoffs. They're the first team ever to go down 2-0 three different times in the playoffs. Ideally, you know, if they do advance past this series, I would advise them to stop falling into 2-0 deficits. But it's working for them so far. It's so impressive for this team to be able to overcome all that they have. And regardless of what happens moving forward, even if the Suns do beat them in the series, because like you, I still lean the Suns to win. Doing this, especially without Kawhi, like I do not want to hear Clippers slander, regardless of how the series goes moving forward. No Clippers slander this summer. They've done more than I ever would have expected out of this group, especially given the circumstances.
Totally agree. And the fact that they win a game where Paul George shoots under 35% from the field.
Yeah.
I think that says so much to that supporting cast that just stepped up. By the way, Luke Kennard. I mean, he just comes in with those timely shots. Like, if it's not for him adding that threat of the three-pointer, I mean, that's huge. That's why I've been so perplexed all year long in terms of why he wasn't playing, why he wasn't given the opportunity. And I know that people keep pointing out, well, he's not a great defender. We've talked about this so many times in these playoffs, but shot-making matters. Shot-making and playmaking, being able to dribble, that trumps defense every single day of the week, especially in the playoffs, because it comes down to you being able to create something out of nothing. He can do that. I mean, okay, he's not Kawhi. He's not Paul George. He can't, like, weave himself through five defenders and end with a layup, sure, but he can play pick-and-roll basketball. He can spot up for three. He can make simple reads. Sometimes he made advanced reads. Give this guy 30-plus minutes. I don't see why not.
Yeah, well, I mean, Terrence Mann, too. He was in and out of the rotation, yeah. And now it's just, finally, Ty Lue is just like, oh, no, this guy's actually very good, and we need him, especially with Marcus Morris banged up. He's been nursing some knee soreness and looks pretty clearly limited out there. So, yeah, I mean, the supporting cast between Jackson, Mann, Kennard, it's awesome to see these guys be stepping up in the absence of Kawhi.
Did you see what Sindarius Thorne wrote
on Twitter?
Yep. I love that, though. No, I mean, that was fair. That was fair. He was just speaking his truth, saying, you know what? When I was with the Clippers, I had to look over my shoulder. And, you know, Terrence Mann doesn't. He gets just the green card, the green light. He gets a chance to just hoop. I think that was pretty, like, that was a nice little insight into how the world was with the Clippers when Doc ran the show.
Yep. Has not been a banner week for Doc Rivers. I'll say that much.
That is true.
Okay, let's go to the other series now. And speaking of not having a banner week or a banner game, the Milwaukee Bucks, after once again letting go of the rope in game one of the Eastern Conference Finals, and they just did their typical Bucks thing, where they just played stupid and, you know, let the Hawks steal that game. Game two, they did not. Game two, they came out much more focused and just beat the ever-living hell out of the Hawks, 125-91. Trae Young has a miserable game, 9 turnovers, 6 of 16 from the field. It was just a complete beatdown. I'm also just so happy to see Drew Holiday getting back into a groove after, you know, having a pretty miserable series against the Nets. Chris Middleton also had terrible game one, a lot better in game two, 15 points on 6 of 13 shooting, 8 assists, 7 rebounds. What did you see out of the Bucks, more aside from them just not playing like idiots? How did they turn this thing around in game two to such a drastic degree?
So, full disclosure, I watched the first half, and then I was like, I'm good.
It's all you needed to watch.
Yeah, and it's because it's very late in the night, so, you know, for me to save myself from watching the second half also means more sleep.
Yeah. But the fourth quarter, it was garbage time the entire fourth quarter.
Okay, so I didn't miss much.
No.
No, all right. Well, in the first half, what I saw was just, and it sounds so basic and so simplistic, but I saw aggressiveness, Brian.
Yeah.
I saw determination. I saw a team that was like, nope, we're not going to accept what happened in game one. We're going to get to the basket. We're going to create open threes. We're going to create open shots. We're going to move the ball. We're going to share the ball. We're playing with a determination that we otherwise frequently forget how to. And I don't know really, like, the X's and O's of it. I can't go into details on that too much because, again, these games, Brian, they start at 2:30 in the morning. There are limits to how much I can absorb at that point in time. But what I did recognize was just, they were able to give Giannis some passes in transition where I think he was really effective. He had that great spin move. That was more of a half-court situation, though, where, and I don't even remember who he did it on, but it was just sort of a Jordan move. He made the spin, and then he came up with the right hand, and then he kind of flipped it. Who was that against? Who did he do? Did he do that on Capella?
Oh, early in the game?
Right. Yeah. No, that was super early.
Yeah.
But that play, I think that started something as
yes.
well.
Yes. Yeah.
Like that really, it was something like, oh, like he got him to an extent where, Like, everyone was just hyping that up. It was sort of like that became, oh, we can do that.
Right.
We can actually do this all game long. We can assert ourselves. We can actually play our brand. We can cramp our style of basketball down their throats.
Yeah.
It became a, I don't know how to frame it. It just became a sense. Like, you could sense it. You could sense that the tide turned when Giannis did that. Which, instead of, it feels like they've played so passively throughout the course of the playoffs. Like, they've been so unsure of themselves. Like, are we overthinking this pass? Are we overthinking this execution? Yada, yada, yada. This time around, there was none of that. Mm-hmm. It was like, okay, we got, throw it there. There's a shot. Boom. It was simple basketball. And maybe that's just what they need. Like, when they come out and run, get to the basket.
Right.
When someone doubles, find the open man. Maybe that's just the way they have to play now. Simple basketball. Don't overthink it. Just don't aspire to have great advanced sets. Just move, drive and kick. And if it's a one-on-one situation with Giannis, go take care of it.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think that was it. They'd stop settling for jumpers when they didn't have to. Like, right. I feel like that's what I mean when I say they play stupid. Like, they just settle for dumb shots a lot. When it's like, right, you know, you're 16 seconds left in the shot clock and you're firing it open. Like, not even, you know, like a pull-up three. Like, that's the best shot you can get. At least try, you know, at least try for a few more seconds. Run another set. Run some action. And if you can't generate another good look by 8 seconds, that shot's still going to be there.
Right.
This game, I mean, again, these stats are to some extent skewed because it was garbage time for an entire quarter. But points in the paint, 62 for Milwaukee, 30 for Atlanta.
Yeah.
I think that was the story of the game. Offensively, I mean, Trey had a bad game, but I think it's a testament to the Bucks too. I think defensively, they were a lot more squared into what they wanted to do. Like, game one, the way that Bud was talking early in the game, it sounded like the plan was, we're going to let Trey go for 40, but we're going to try to cut him off as a passer, stick with the other guys, and limit his damage that way. The problem is they did not. they got 48 points, but he also got 11 assists, so they took nothing away from him. The, you know, Brook Lopez is dropping deep around the basket. That is never going to work against Trey Young. He had the floater game going early, and that leads to an avalanche of threes, and then he can start getting layup. Like, then he just gets into such a rhythm, and he can throw you off. We didn't see that in game two. They had Brook play a little bit higher. Bobby Portis wasn't dropping. He was switching more defensively, which is how you want to play Bobby Portis. I think Drew, you know, after game one was saying, like, I just need to play more aggressively. I need to stick closer to Trey. Like, I know he is going to try to bait and draw fouls, but he didn't in game two. I think he took he got three free throw attempts. But I think he only drew one foul, if I remember correctly.
Well, he drew one on, I think it was Middleton, in the first or second quarter, where he did that, you know, the thing that they're going to be talking about in the summer with the what's it called? The competition committee?
Yeah, the thing they're going to outlaw, and then Trey Young's going to turn into a pumpkin.
Yeah.
No, I'm kidding. He's going to be good still, but it's a big part of his game. Yes.
Right. And like, he got that one, but otherwise, at least from what I saw for the first half, he was sort of overwhelmed. He didn't have the same freedom. He didn't have the same shoulder pop as well. The shimmy wasn't really there. But I think, like, for Drew, when you said aggressive, just in terms of aggressive, I didn't even think defensively, although that's a great point by Drew. I'm thinking offensively. Like, how many times this year have we seen him just sort of settle into, like, step back long twos or threes, and, like, where you just go, that's not your game. Like, you're 6'3", 6'4", 215. You're like a big, strong dude. You can get to the basket. You can get layups. You can get fouled and get to the free throw line. You can do these things. And it seems to me now that he's finding, like, that balance, offensively speaking, where, okay, if I have a mismatch, I'm no longer afraid to attack it. But also, when I have an open three, I can take it. So it's not like he's sacrificing on any level. He's just being more wise about his shot selection, I think. So he's the key to me. The key to me coming down is Jrue Holiday. Like, Giannis will get his in one way or the other. Chris Middleton will get his one way or the other. It's Jrue. Jrue has to get his on both ends of the floor. That's why they traded for him. That's why they paid him that amount of money as well. Well, also to make sure that Giannis resigns. But he's crucial, is my point. They need to see him get more points, you know, get more defensive stops, need to play him more physical basketball. And he's doing that right now. The question I have, Brian, I'm going to throw it back to you now, is there a risk that Dump Bucks return for Game 3?
It's always a risk, as long as Mike Budenholzer is the coach.
Right.
But I think the extent to which they beat the Hawks down, like, this was my thing going into this series. I picked the Bucks in 5 because, like, talent-wise, the Bucks should not lose a game in this series. I thought there was a chance that Trae Young goes off, which he did in Game 1. I thought there was a chance the Bucks shot themselves in the foot, which they also did in Game 1. But when the Bucks are playing well, like, there is a double-digit margin separating these teams.
Right.
So I would hope that this gives them the template that they need moving forward.
Right.
And, you know, for in terms of Atlanta, like, what counterpunches they have, I don't know. I mean, the Bucks were really, really targeting both Trey and Gallo on defense. I mean, Gallo, I think, was a minus 25 in, like, 12... How many minutes did they play? 15? Yeah. Minus 25. Or
oh, boy.
16 almost.
Yeah.
But the worst plus minus of anyone on the bench, and I think that's true. You know, single game plus minus can be noisy. That one was not. They were really, really, really going after him. And this was, you know, part of the problem that we diagnosed going into this series is without DeAndre Hunter,
right,
the Hawks just don't have good defensive wings. Cam Reddish actually played in this game.
He did.
Which I did not expect. He was, you know, they said he was available before the game. It turned into such a blowout that he could get his first live game action in a couple months, which was nice to see. You know, I think he's been so out of it for so long that I don't think he's going to make a major impact on this series. But, I mean, this is, you know, when you're having to rely on Solomon Hill and Tony Snell as your, like, primary wing defenders, because, like, Bogdanovich is still hampered by the knee. Kevin Huerter is not a great wing defender by any means. So, like, this was the series that both Jrue and Chris could get things going. And I think, you know, from the Bucks' perspective, you feel bad that you lost Game 1 when, you know, you very easily could have won that game. But Chris going 6 of 23 from the field, Trey having 48, 11, and 7, and you only lost by 3 points. Right. Like, you know, I feel like you leave that game actually feeling pretty good about your chances in the series moving forward.
I mean, yeah. Look, Trey went from, I have to look it up, being responsible for 28 made field goals in Game 1 to 9 in the second. That is such a dramatic change that the Bucks have to figure, you know, he's going to come back from that. He's not going to be as bad in Game 2, but you also don't want him to be as effective as in Game 1. So, like, they need to strike that right balance. Also, even to give them maybe a false sense of security a little bit, like, because if you shut down Trae Young offensively, he's still a tremendous, tremendous playmaker. He will adapt to certain situations. So I think it's kind of crucial you still give him a chance to also just score a little bit, so maybe he starts chasing certain shots. We'll see what happens. But by the way, like, even in a game where he was really not great, that free throw line, and, like, just the entire paint, he can get buckets and passes off in every single scenario you put him in the paint. It is ridiculous, really, how calm he is in those situations. Like, and like you said this before, the Hawks are playing with house money. Right now, I'm looking at the Hawks and this run that they're on as Trae Young playoff development.
Yeah,
he's going to be so dangerous next year. It's uncanny.
Yeah, I mean, I think we'll talk about the Hawks probably within the week. when we do their by Felicia, and I'm going to write about it for Forbes as well, because they're in a weird spot in terms of roster building. But if there are some good things to come out of this playoff run, aside for like long term, one, Trae Young, you know, obviously needs to get better defensively, but he's proving that he's so elite offensively. Like, if they have any questions about maxing this guy, those are out the window.
Right.
You know, August 2nd or whatever the day is where you can put that extension, say, you write it, we don't care. Like, we'll give you whatever you want. You want the 5-year max, you want the designated rookie, great, fine.
Were there ever concerns about that? Were there ever doubt?
I hope not, but I mean, I could see, you know, going into, if you're Atlanta and you hadn't seen Trae in the playoffs before, you're definitely going to max him either way, just because,
right,
that's what you have to do for a player like this.
Yeah.
But you might have been more nervous about it than, like, now there should be no nerves whatsoever.
I wasn't nervous because he, in his second year, averaged almost 30-10.
Yeah, but like in the play, you know, the regular season and the playoffs are different. And knowing that,
yes,
in the playoffs, that matchup hunting becomes much more of a thing, and that Trae is one of the worst defenders in the NBA.
Right.
The Hawks very well could have been worried that he is, you know, we know what he can do offensively, but teams are going to go after this guy every single time.
But it doesn't
matter.
He's
proving that. Yeah, right. He's proving it doesn't matter.
But I think, and this is a point we've made before, when you have these superbly great offensive players, like we had this conversation, I think, 2 or 3 years ago with James Harden, where, oh, defensive concerns, defense, who cares? Who cares? Like, oh, James Harden is responsible for players scoring 20 points. Yeah, but he's like averaging 35 and 8 assists on his own. Doesn't matter.
Right.
Like,
right.
It's the weirdest, like, the whole defense like thing is so weird to me. Like, again, I'm not trying to downplay defense, but like, yeah, offense is more important. It's not the 80s anymore. Get with the program.
Yeah, and I mean, even if someone goes after Trae every time, okay, they blow by him, you still have Clint Capella that they have to get through. Yes. Or they can pull up for jumpers, but they're still, like, you're not going to hit 100% of pull-up jumpers.
And next year, they'll have a second year Onyeka Okongwu backing up Clint Capella, so virtually in all 48 minutes, they're going to have a rim protector.
Yeah, yeah. The Hawks are, we'll talk about them more moving forward. But
we should get Adam on for that.
Yeah, we definitely, well, no, he's going to be mad when I told him about this article I'm writing last night. He didn't respond to me, so. So it's tied 1-1 going back to Atlanta, but that beat down, the Bucks are now a -390 favorite to win the series. Where do you lean here, Mort?
Bucks, still. I mean, I had the Bucks going in, but I didn't feel great about it. I still don't. I'm not at that point where I'm just going to kick back and go, oh, sure, because dumb Bucks can always rear its heads. Like, I wouldn't be shocked if this goes 6, where it shouldn't have gone, like, more than 5.
Right.
And hell, then even in game 6, then maybe late in the game they do something really weird, and then boom, it's a game 7. Like, they just have this tendency. So, Bucks, but I don't feel great about it. I feel somewhat confident, at best.
Yeah, I mean, we saw it with the Sixers. They choked away 2 giant leads against this Hawks team. This Hawks team doesn't quit.
They don't.
But they are not a team that you want to give life to, because they showed in the second round what happens if you play with your food 1 too many times.
Yes, correct.
Before we move to the coaches, I do want to ask quickly, if you had to pick today, and I want to do this every episode until we crown a champion, who would you pick as your NBA champion?
Oh, man. It's down to the Bucks or Suns for me.
Yeah.
I'm going to say Bucks, just because, like, the Suns weren't even in the playoffs last year. And not to say, obviously, neither team has been in the finals, so that's a different experience. But I do think Giannis and Chris, Andrew, are a little bit more experienced. Not, of course, I recognize Chris Paul has been there before, but Devin Booker hasn't. DeAndre Ayton hasn't. Mikal Bridges hasn't. So I think the Bucks, who have spent 3 years basically building themselves up for this moment, I think mentally there might be a little bit more geared towards it because it's become an expectation. Whereas you could argue in a certain way, Phoenix is also playing with house money. Like, we didn't expect them to go this far. I know the Suns fans did, and kudos to Suns fans for that. But I think there's a slight homeristic angle to that when you, like, in the middle of the season went, oh, the Suns are going to win it all. Like, they might, but, like, that wasn't really super reasonable take at that point in time. So maybe they also come into a final series just basically like the Hawks and goes, you know what? No expectations. Let's just go out and hoop. That would be fun, by the way, but we'll see. I'm going Bucks because I think it's time. I really do. And then I think it would be hilarious if they fired Bud maybe a month later. They won't, but that would be hilarious.
No, no. If they were going to do it, they needed to do it already.
Right.
But, yeah, I mean, I think the Bucks are the most talented team left in the playoffs. Mm-hmm. But like you, I'm afraid of dumb Bucks emerging at any moment. And I keep saying this, like, half facetiously, but regardless of who advances out of the Clippers or the Suns, we both think the Suns will. But if it's Clippers, the same point applies. The coaching mismatch is going to be the biggest mismatch of the finals.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that worries me. Because, like, Monty Williams, even though he's going from a talent deficit, I don't know, man.
He's good.
Yeah. I almost lean Suns right now if I had to pick. But I
wouldn't be shocked.
Yeah.
And also, if by somehow, some way, the Bucks dumb themselves out of this series.
Oh my god.
No, if they do, I think you and I should absolutely refuse to call them the Milwaukee Bucks next year. It's going to be the Milwaukee Ducks.
Oh man. I really hope for their sake that they do, that they win it all this year, frankly. But god, if they blow this series.
Yeah.
Like, such a winnable series. This is probably going to be their best chance to win a title, because the Nets are going to come back next year. You know, if they stay healthy, they're going to be right back in the front runners to win the title.
Right.
The path is never going to be easier than it is right now for the Bucks. So now they don't have to go against LeBron. Like, oh god, yeah. So for their sake, I hope. Like, I want to see them play for a coach where they don't have to win in spite of him or her.
Yeah.
Like, they actually, their coach helps them win.
Yeah.
They won't have that luxury this year. But I think, you know, the talent gap between them and Atlanta in particular is so great that I don't think they have to worry about it. And then we'll see who comes out of the West. But, like, you know, just looking ahead, who won? Phoenix stands a chance against Giannis.
Yeah, they're probably gonna use DeAndre on him, right?
Or Crowder, probably, right?
Oh, but that's toast.
Well, I mean, last year with Miami,
it was, yeah, I understand that, but that was a team that also had Jimmy Butler, Bam Adebayo, Andre Iguodala. There was a lot of moving pieces there, and plus, I think Giannis still is the type of player who on occasion just figure somebody out. And like, and not to the, like, from a tactical perspective, but more along the lines, like, he starts realizing, oh, I'm Giannis Antetokounmpo, you're Jay Crowder. You know what? Right. That's not a contest. And then he just kind of catches himself going, I shouldn't be scared of you. So I'm going to take you to the basket every single time. And lo and behold, I've just dunked on your face three times in a row. So I'm not really concerned about Jay Crowder. Cameron Johnson, I think, could be interesting. Not because he's like an otherworldly defender, but he's long, he's quick-footed. Yeah. Like, he's not necessarily a bad option to put on Giannis in that regard.
Yeah, they have Dario too. Like, they have size.
Yeah,
and you know, no one would consider Blake Griffin an elite defender, especially at this point in his career. But
no,
the difference between like him and Jeff Green going against Giannis in that Nets series was pretty stark. So, right.
And that's because the best defender to put on Giannis is Giannis's own brain.
Yeah, right. Or Mike Budenholzer. Yeah. And I mean, for the J point in particular, like, we saw what happened to the Miami Heat in the first round this year. It seemed like Giannis and the Bucks had some demons to cleanse, and they did so very efficiently in round one. I'm sure if they get a rematch against Jake Crowder in the finals, they will be looking forward to that.
They should
wash everything away that happened last year, make it all better. So now, Mort, let's turn to some coaching news. And the reason that the Bucks missed their window to fire Mike Budenholzer is because Rick Carlisle is no longer on the market. After leaving the Dallas Mavericks, he quickly agreed to terms with the Indiana Pacers on a 4-year, $29 million contract. He is going back. He coached there for 4 years back in the mid-2000s. I mean, there have been plenty of reports kind of detailing why Carlisle left when he did. And, you know, I don't want to call it like a toxic culture, but it didn't seem like things were especially great in Dallas at the end there with Donnie Nelson feuding with Bob. I don't even remember his last name. Bulgaris?
Haralabob or whatever.
Yeah, Haralabob, yeah. And then, yeah, Carlisle and Luka apparently didn't quite see eye to eye all the time. What do you think about Indiana, you know, at 1 year after the failed Nate Bjorkgren experiment, where at least bringing in a coach who, very experienced, won a championship with the Mavericks in 2010-11.
Right.
He has not won a playoff series since then, though, Mort. So what do you think about the Carlisle hire for Indiana and his fit with the roster?
I mean, it's definitely an upgrade. Just to have someone as competent as Rick Carlisle on the sideline, absolutely. It really depends on the roster, though. At the end of the day, a coach is only as good as the quality of his roster, Tom Thibodeau not necessarily withstanding. And I just wonder, what is this roster going to look like? Because we heard everything from locker room issues to a lot of people internally believing that the Sabonis Turner front court doesn't work, that you need to do something else. Like, what is this roster going to look like? Are they going to retool? Are they going to rebuild? Are they going to stay mostly together and work from within? I don't know, but I do think, regardless of what they do, be it rebuild, retool, stay together, that Rick Carlisle is going to come in and be serious right off the bat and help them develop, help them get better. So that's a positive. But I also, just for his sake, I'm enormously curious to see what they end up doing with this roster.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, they are at a very weird point in their team building. Because, I mean, look, they have most of their main players under contract, I think, for the next 2 years at least, right? I mean, Brogdon, Sabonis, Turner, and LeVert are all under contract through 22-23. TJ Warren, Jeremy Lamb are under contract for the upcoming season as well. Justin Holiday is signed through 22-23. The only notable free agents they have this offseason are TJ McConnell and Doug McDermott. So, you know, we had Caitlin Cooper on back before Bjorkgren got fired.
Yeah.
And we were talking about, like, is run it back a viable strategy for this team? I think you can make the argument that it is. You know, are they a top-tier title contender with this roster? No. But, you know, with Rick Carlisle coaching, with better health, if the guys don't check out halfway through, I think it's a pretty clear, safe playoff team, right?
Yeah, it should be. If it's not, something is wrong. We're talking about the Jokic of the East in Sabonis, and I don't know why there are NBA media members who hate him. I will never understand that. I think he's 20-12, almost 7 assists, over 50% from the field. I mean, I just don't see the issue with Sabonis whatsoever. You have Malcolm Brogdon, who I'm not going to get into too much because you and I already went deep on Malcolm Brogdon when we did our Ben Simmons video on YouTube. So if you haven't checked that out, go to there. Caris LeVert, offensive upside, playmaking upside, shot creation upside. You just have so much shot-making versatility in him. He's going to be... I thought when they had Victor Oladipo, this team was very robotic, very Lithuanian in the sense that everything had to move in certain patterns. But LeVert is the guy who comes in and does something weird or wild, and like he can create something out of nothing. And I think they needed that craziness a little bit just to kind of shake up their offense a little bit. Then they have Miles Turner, DPOY candidate, obviously. Will never transform himself into the offensive player that you and I have hoped for, but that may be okay. Like, TJ Warren, I don't know if we're getting bubble TJ or if we're getting some other version, but he can definitely put the ball in the basket. O'Shea Brissett played wonderfully during his stint this year. They're like Edmund Sumner, they're good. They have tremendous talent. They might actually be one of the most talented teams in the entire Eastern Conference. And they just didn't really put it together. So if there's a guy out there who might be able to, that should be Carlisle. Do they have enough shot making, like from an individual perspective? I don't know. Do they have enough overall defense? I don't know. There are definitely some issues there. But I think if you can plug some holes and you can just get together as a group and not have a fractured locker room as well, that's a pretty good start.
Right. I mean, the good thing from Indiana's perspective is that if they do want to retool, which I think is a viable strategy for them this offseason, none of their guys are severely overpaid. I mean, Brogdon is the most, he's earning the most of any Pacer at $21.7 million next year.
And he's underpaid.
So is Sabonis at 19.8. Yes. You know, Miles Turner at 18 is a pretty reasonable contract. Yep. LeVert at 17.5. TJ Warren at 12.9.
Yep.
Jeremy Lamb is probably their most overpaid player at 10.5. But, like, they have plenty of salary matching chips if they want to get in on a bigger deal. Like, right. If they finally decide we're breaking up Sabonis and Turner, you know, fine. It should be pretty easy to find a taker for one of those two teams, especially now that Danny Ainge isn't in the league anymore.
Big time.
But I mean, it is, I think that the Carlisle fit's going to be interesting because of his reputation with point guards in particular. I'm interested to see what happens with Malcolm Brogdon, but you know, having a Caris LeVert there, like you just come off of having a non-traditional point guard in Luka, and I'm not saying Caris LeVert is anywhere near the talent of Luka Doncic. But he's also a guy who can handle the ball a lot. And hell, I mean, Sabonis, a lot of your offense is going to run through him. So I'm fascinated to see how Carlisle adjusts to either this roster, if they keep it in place, or however the Pacers decide to retool this summer, you know, what specific needs they address. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's go now, Mort. That was the good news in terms of coaching hires.
Yeah, I'm bracing myself.
Yeah, so the other one, the Dallas Mavericks, like within hours of Rick Carlisle endorsing Jason Kidd as their next head coach, they at least, I believe, came to terms with him and hired him as their next head coach. Carlisle said, you know, he coached, I think he was like, I'm the only one who coached both Kidd and Luka, so I can say that both of these guys would be a great fit together. And clearly the Mavericks agree. You know, Dirk Nowitzki is working with them as a special advisor, I believe. And, you know, he had experience with Kidd on the 2010-11 title team, so he's bringing that to the table as well. What do you think of the Kidd hire, Mort?
I think you know where I stand on the Jason Kidd hire. I do not like it. First and foremost, I think he's a person that the NBA should distance itself from. Secondarily, I don't think he's a good coach. I think there's a reason that Giannis took a step up after his departure in Milwaukee.
Yeah.
I think he had no clue on how to handle Giannis, what to do with Giannis. He insisted on pushing the point guard label onto Giannis for no particular reason. I think he is a guy who gets power hungry, power grabby. He did so after a single year in with the Brooklyn Nets, then he started angling for more power. So I actually, when I heard this, I went to a website and created a countdown clock.
Did you really?
Yeah, basically saying, you know what, let's give it a year and maybe about a month, and like a year and change. And then at one point we'll hear when that countdown has done, at before then we will have had either a scandal, or we'll had a Jason Kidd Howard grab attempt.
Oh, I thought you were going to say a Luka Doncic trade request.
That's a scandal, Brian. That counts under a scandal.
Okay. Yeah, it's like the clock from Independence Day. You don't know what it's for, but you know when exactly. It hits zero, something bad's going to happen.
Yep, exactly. And look, I mean, there are probably Dallas fans out there going, oh, well, we like Jason Kidd. Jason Kidd was there when we won a championship. Jason Kidd was the co-rookie of the year with Grant Hill when we drafted him. Yada, yada. That's great. That's great. But you know what? There is widely available information about him privately that makes me just not interested in having a person like him associated with the NBA and the sport that I cover.
Yeah, so let's get into that, because this is going to apply to Portland as well.
Yes.
So in January of 2001, he was arrested because his wife told police that he hit her during an argument over their son. He pleaded guilty to spousal abuse, was fined $200, and was ordered to take anger management training. So, you know, domestic abuse is not something that should be taken lightly,
right.
Obviously. I mean, the Mavericks, like, this is very public information at this point. And I think a lot of, from what I saw, when his name started circulating, like, you know, his name's been connected to every coaching search for like the last couple years at this point.
Yeah. I wonder why his agency has done a really good job of being in the ear of Adrian Wojnarowski off of ESPN.
Yeah. And I feel like every time his name surfaces, I see someone from the fan base write a blog post about why they should not hire him. And it always comes back. Not only to the domestic abuse, but also, like, yeah, he was not a great coach as well. So it's not even like this guy's a magnificent, like, Phil Jackson-esque savant, and we just are blackballing him because of an issue from 20 years ago. It's like, this guy kind of sucked, and then also has this issue that you should not be overlooking by any means. So it's like, when there are 30 jobs available, and only 30 jobs available...
Right.
Do we have, like, this is the best you can do? And,
yeah.
You know, it's not to say that it won't work out for the Mavericks, but I think, especially for a team, you know, coming off of a major sexual harassment scandal for the past few years,
yeah.
Where, you know, Mark Cuban pledges to change the culture of the organization, making your first hire someone with a past history of domestic abuse does not send a great message, not only to women in the organization, but just women in general, or any victims of domestic abuse, male or female.
Right.
So, you know, I think they are deservedly getting raked over the coals for this. And again, maybe it works out. Like, you know, Jason Kidd, I feel like the logic from their perspective is, we know what Jason Kidd brings to the table as a player. He's a Hall of Fame point guard.
Right.
We have Luka Doncic. Who, you know, if you're going to, like, it's like when you're not going to necessarily get this reference, but NFL teams, when you have an elite quarterback, you're looking for a new head coach, you typically, you know, bring in someone who's either quarterback when he played in the NFL or has a lot of background, like an offensive-minded coach.
Okay, yeah.
It's similar to this. You have an elite point guard in Luka Doncic, you're going to want someone with the same type of mentality. I think that's what Carlisle was referring to as well. But I do think, as NBA fans, we should be upfront about the issues that come with this hire. And both for this and the Portland one, which we'll get to in a few minutes, I don't want this to come off, you know, I've seen some people label this as like performative outrage. And I think that's a gross labeling of this.
Yeah.
Like, we should not be okay with someone with this past getting a premier job and not at least being questioned about it. You know, like, you know, I hope that in his introductory press conference, someone asks either him or whoever is in charge of the Dallas front office now, I think, you know, Michael Finley and then this Nike executive who they just hired, Nico Harrison. Like, I want someone to get comments on the record of how did you weigh what you know, positive factors you think Kidd brings to the table with what he has in his past.
Right, and it's not just 20 years ago, Brian. When Jumana Kidd and Jason Kidd got divorced in 2007, I mean, she claimed that he broke her rib and damaged her hearing by smashing her head into the console of a car. I mean, that is out there. At the same time, in 2012, he was arrested for driving under the influence. So I think it's not just a question of what he did 20 years ago. I mean, that case, the latest case is less than 9 years old. That, to me, presents a pattern of destruction in a certain way. And so it's not just the you're right, the Mavericks should address this, but they shouldn't just address what happened 20 years ago. They should address more than that. They should address character overall. Like, they should justify. They should try to justify why this is okay. And I want to hear that. I want to hear them try to justify it because I don't think they can. And in the context of what happened with that organization especially, I just think this is such a tone-deaf move.
Yeah.
That is when I heard this, I was flabbergasted. And today I know this is almost a segue, but it almost sounded like off of a tweet from Damian Lillard earlier that he more or less declined the opportunity to work with Kidd because of those issues.
Mm-hmm.
So as soon as we get into the Portland stuff, because there's also, this has not been a banner day for the NBA. And we've said that a couple times on this podcast today. It hasn't been a banner day for X amount of people. I think you're right. It is important that we, as fans, observers, analysts, whatever, get some answers to this. Because, look, the NBA still has a tendency to, once in a while, bring out Karl Malone. Hey, look at Karl. Are you freaking kidding me? In no way, shape, or form should the NBA be associated with Karl Malone. No way.
Yeah, well, Scoutman just heard that from miles away, and he's going to come DM you later.
Yeah, I'm okay with that.
Well, I mean, also, too, beyond, like, all those factors very much deserve to be in consideration here, but this is from Tim Cato of The Athletic. It also might cost them Jamal Mosley, who is an assistant coach.
It has cost them, right?
It's expected he's going to depart the franchise. I don't know if it's official. But Doncic had developed a close relationship with him. You know, it sounded like when Carlisle left, like, that was the logical choice.
Right.
Potentially. But instead, you know, he, again, this is Tim Cato of The Athletic, says he failed to receive the serious consideration he anticipated for the vacant coaching role. And then later on he says, however, it's clear Kidd didn't beat out Mosley as much as he was whisked past him in a preferred lane.
Yeah. So basically, so, I mean, what you're telling me is OKC is gearing up for a Luka offer.
Well, so that's, I do want to touch on that quickly, because I know that's going to be the, like, again, half facetiously, when I, similar to my Bud versus Monty is the worst mismatch in the finals.
Right.
If Luka, as long as Luka signs that extension, Dallas doesn't need to worry.
Right.
Or, like, if they do, it's years down the road. Like, we've seen guys force their way out with 1 year left or 2 years off left on their contract. He cannot force his way out with 6 years left.
Right.
And even if he starts dogging it like James Harden did in Houston, no, there's no way. You cannot possibly get the value that you would need for Luka Doncic at 22 years old or whatever he is,
right?
That, you know, an MVP caliber talent. There's just absolutely no way. So I don't think a trade request is likely. If anything, what will happen is Jason Kidd will flame out and they'll fire him. And then, you know, then he'll get more say in the next coach and then they'll be on the clock. But, like, I don't think this is going to cost them Luka Doncic. What I hope is, again, personal issues aside, which are very much in consideration, but just from an on-court fit, I hope that Jason Kidd has learned from his time in Milwaukee. And, you know, the Lakers people apparently have been raving about him. Mm-hmm. So maybe being around LeBron the last couple of years and Anthony Davis the last couple of years has helped bring him new perspective, and he's going to be a much better coach as a result. But I just hope we don't waste 2 years of Luka Doncic because they went with a nepotism hire.
I think that's going to happen, though.
It might have happened either way because their roster is in such rough shape, especially with Porzingis. But, like, you know, I don't get the impression that Jason Kidd is going to be a Monty Williams or a Ty Lue.
No, I think this is a clear downgrade. If we're setting aside all the personality issues, I just don't think he's a smart coach. I mean, Rick Carlisle, even though he butted heads with Luka, and I made this point on this podcast before, he still appreciated Luka to a great extent. Mm-hmm. It was a disagreement just off of like passion and having their emotions on their sleeves. That does not mean that there is the mutual level of respect. That does not mean that there isn't a great sense of shared, let's say, urgency for becoming a better team. I think that was there. I think the reason he resigned, honestly, is because of all of the hoopla happening behind the scenes. I mean, as we've learned, Mark Cuban is a meddler, a big meddler. And apparently he does not know exactly who to give the right level of responsibility to, and then even if he does do that, he sort of circles back and inserts himself into the conversation because of his ego. And that might have been adorable when he started out as a new owner, you know, 20 odd years ago, because we didn't see that. Nowadays, it's gotten a little bit old. It's time for a change, and honestly, if I'm Luka Doncic, or if I'm a fan of Luka Doncic, I mean, I am worried that the next couple of years are going to be very irrelevant. I think they're going to be somewhat like stuck in the mud. And honestly, I wouldn't be entirely shocked if he took the qualifying offer. I wouldn't. Like, if he is desperate enough to get out of Dodge in 2 years' time. That would be in 2 years' time, but it would be after next year that he could do it. Who knows? I know what he said, though. I understand that he said, what do you think, in terms of the extension? But who knows?
Yeah, I mean, he winked and was like, yes, I'm effectively
right, right. But going I mean, to take it. And then, and, I don't know. It's such a tough situation because then if he gets injured, is that contract going to be there?
Right.
Look, this is where it's so difficult, right? It's so difficult because when you have a guy like that, you would want him to play under the best of circumstances. These are not the best of circumstances. You should, as an organization, really try to mold yourself after your star player. I don't think this is doing that.
Yeah. Yep. Nope. I completely agree. All right. So let's just go right into the other one because this one, the Blazers still have time to back out. This is not final. But multiple reporters, Adrian Wojnarowski, Shams Charania of The Athletic, et cetera, have all reported Chauncey Billups are progressing in contract talks to make him the next head coach of the team. And it's similar to Jason Kidd in some extent, where the guys who work with him currently have raved about him. You know, Ty Lue especially has gone on and on about how great of a job Chauncey Billups has done, how he deserves to be a head coach. So, as of a few weeks ago, I don't think this was as well known as it is now. And I, you know, for those of you who do know it, kudos, but we want to bring it up because I don't think everyone who isn't on NBA Twitter all the time is necessarily aware of this.
Right.
In 1997, a victim, Jane Doe, accused him and a few of his teammates at the time on the Boston Celtics, Antoine Walker and Ron Mercer, of rape. Billups said that the woman initiated and performed consensual oral sex on him in the car, which was the full extent of their sexual interactions. She said they went back to, I think it was Walker's house, and all three of them had non-consensual sex with her.
Right.
That's all we know in terms of, you know, it is much like most sexual assault cases, it's he said, she said, and we don't have clear evidence either way. But it is an allegation of rape. And, you know, I think as as he started catching more steam in these coaching searches, it became more and more well known. I also want to read you Damian Lillard's tweet today about it. You know, because a lot of people, when this news broke, were pretty upset, and deservedly so. So someone said this was on Dame. They were always going to hire exactly who he wanted. And Dame said, "Really? I was asked what coaches I like of the names I heard, and I named them. Sorry I wasn't aware of their history. I didn't read the news when I was 7 or 8 years old. I don't support those things, but if this the route y'all want to come at me, say less." So how do you digest all that, Mort?
Well, for one thing is, so our buddy Mason Ginsburg said something interesting. He said, if I'm going to suggest to my company that they make a hire, I would be responsible for also knowing, like, what's the history of the person that I am caping for.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think NBA players will ever do that. But I actually agree with Mason that if they're going to basically, let's say, you know, stick out their neck for a guy, that it's important you know who you're sticking your neck out for. Mm-hmm. I don't blame Dame for not reading the news at 7 or 8. Nobody does.
Right. Well, again, like, most of us didn't know about this a month ago.
Right. Absolutely. But and then, I mean, the thing for me is, if you're caping for someone, then sure, I think it would be fine if you just take the time and went back and like, okay, let's see who the person is that I'm caping for, that I'm saying okay to. But I'm also understanding that the responsibility doesn't fall on Dame, ultimately speaking. It's the organization. The organization is hired to do background, or the organization hires someone to do background. My apologies. It's past midnight. It's late.
Yeah, you're good.
And like, if an organization doesn't do that, then it's on. I mean, and if they get, or they get that, you know, they get a report back detailing these things, and they still go, "Well, it's fine," then mm-hmm. it's on them. I mean,
yeah.
So like, I can see it from both sides when it comes to Dame, like. Yes, it would have been great if he did know, because it did seem like that he didn't want any part of Jason Kidd because of that reputation. So that suggested to people, myself included, that, oh, you know, Dame wants to be socially conscious. I think he is. I mean, overall, when I picture Dame Lillard personally, he's a guy who really seems like he has the finger on the pulse. So I think that was what hit people by surprise a little bit. Him basically saying, hey, you know what? I didn't know. Yeah, I mean, I get it. At the same time, I still feel like, yeah, but it would have been nice if you knew. Like, it would have been pretty good, because then you could have said no, and then it wouldn't have been an issue. But look, this is such a multi-layered discussion, and I really don't want to make it a Damian Lillard issue, to be honest with you. I want to make this a Portland Trailblazers issue. I want this to make it a Neil Olshey issue more than I want to make it a Dame issue.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think the last part of his response was not great. I'm sure his PR people agree. Like,
say less was not a great way to end that discussion.
No, it was not. But yeah, you're right. This isn't on Dame. Like, you hire people to do a background check, like in any job, not just NBA coaches, but like any job interview process. Like, the last part is doing a background check on someone. If something comes up, you know, Chauncey was not arrested, as best I can tell. He was not convicted of anything. So it's not like he has a felony on his on his record. But, like, this would pop up. All you have to do is a Google search to find out about it. So,
And by the way, can we also just acknowledge that a medical examination was conducted and revealed injuries to this woman?
Yes.
You know, what's it called? My apologies if it's a crude term, but rape kit, is that correct? Okay. So I think that matters. I think it's important that we also detail that it's not just, you know, he said, she said, or she revealed something years later. Like, there was a medical examination.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I mean, yeah, this is where it's similar to Kidd. Like, where do you draw the line? You know, like the NBA has had this problem for years now, not just with coaches, but like right. Kobe back in the day, Derrick Rose,
yep.
you know, fans got behind both guys after these allegations come out. Like, does Chauncey Billups never just deserve to work again because he got accused of this 25 years ago? I don't think anyone's going that far. Does he deserve to be one of, you know, in this exclusive fraternity where there are only 30 jobs available, 30 high profile jobs? That I think you can make a pretty strong argument that no, it looks like Blazers Edge put out an article this morning.
Yeah.
With the title, in their own words, five women offer thoughts on Chauncey Billups hire. And it's just clear how disgusted all five of them are with yeah. the organization right now.
I read that. I mean, I don't know if you read it, but that is, I was like, whoa, I was really moved. I think you should all go read that.
Yeah. It's a really, really good piece. And, you know, I think this is, again, it's like something that the organization, similar to Dallas with Kidd, not just, you know, how his past will influence people's feeling toward the hire and like what it means for Jamal Mosley, all that stuff. You know, you have to think about the backlash here if you're Portland. And like, is Chauncey Billups so much of an upgrade over whoever else was in the running? Becky Hammond in particular. Is he so much of an upgrade over her that you're willing to alienate a large portion of your female fan base, because that's the risk you're taking here. Right. And I like, professionally for Billups and for Dame, much like for Kidd and Luka, like, I hope, I don't even know if I want to say I hope it works out. Like, it's so tricky, but man, I mean, it's certainly not a choice that I would make right. if I were in charge of an NBA team. And I, you know, if the Sixers were interviewing these guys, I'd be equally outraged. And I think anyone who thinks people are just putting on a face and like pretending to be mad about this, again, just go listen to women who are very, very pissed, and rightfully so. Like, they deserve a seat at the table here more than any of us do.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, because that was actually going to be my next point. And it is, you know, technically you and I, we shouldn't be having this conversation. This should not be two men sitting and talking about the long-term implications, because you know what? We are privileged as hell in that regard. It is not men who are primarily in fear of being assaulted sexually. It is overwhelmingly, mm-hmm. almost exclusively women. So the message that this sends to half the public is dreadful. This is one of those, well, you know what? I don't really care. It's fine. It's men that watches the sport. Rah, rah, rah kind of decisions. Like, it's not taking into account half the population. It's right. not taking into account the literally millions of women alive today who have suffered or gone through sexual assault. Mm-hmm. And then you could argue, well, we don't know if he did it. Sure. But it's the message that it's sending. Someone who has been accused of that, that still matters. And I understand, to some extent, people saying, well, you know what? You also can't blackball someone if you don't know if someone did it or not. And again, it's a multi-layered discussion. But yeah. have some respect for the many, 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 unfortunately, women who have gone through this, and understand that what you're doing is directly, absolutely directly affecting them. It sends yeah. such a poor message out there.
Yeah. I mean, any survivor of sexual assault who is a Blazers fan, or even not, I mean, just follows the NBA and now has to know that one of the 30 head coaches is going to have this accusation against him.
Right.
Like, what is that going to do? Like, I can't imagine the upside outweighs the downside here. And I, much like with Dallas and Kidd, I hope in Billups' introductory press conference, if they do end up hiring him, I hope someone asks him about this. I hope someone asks Neil O'Shea about this. Like,
I hope several people ask them.
Yeah, like, they deserve to be on the record.
Yeah.
Like, this is not something that you get to hide away from. You know, like, I don't think the Blazers, when they announce Billups hiring, are going to bring this up or issue a statement about this. They should, to be proactive, but I think they're going to try to sweep it under the rug as best as possible.
I don't think they're having a press conference, Brian.
Yeah, well, every team, when they introduce a
head coach, I think that's their way of being progressive.
Yeah.
If you catch my drift. I think they're just going to be issuing a statement. The Blazers have hired, and that's it. Because that's how you skirt around the issue.
Yeah, they'll go into his professional background, and that's it. They're not going to...
And that's the thing. This is what disappoints me. It's the league was trending the right way for years. I think the league just took a significant step back.
Yeah.
When compared to the WNBA, which I continuously am in awe of from a social issues perspective, my God, is the NBA lagging behind?
Yeah.
I love the NBA. I built my life off of basketball. If it hadn't been for the NBA, I wouldn't be sitting with a full-time job right now as a basketball content manager. So I am very emotionally invested in the NBA. This frustrates me. I don't want to speak on your behalf, but you know, I know people in my network who have been a victim of sexual assault. I know several, actually. I'm not going to sit here and name them because that wouldn't be proper, but I know what they've dealt with. All of them. It's and for some sports fans to basically say, well, that doesn't matter because maybe this guy can get us more wins.
Yeah.
Who the fuck cares about wins if it comes at that price?
Yeah. Yeah. I think you said it well. This is not... It's a big step back for the NBA.
It really is.
I hope the reaction... I've been encouraged, at least, by how many people have voiced their displeasure with both of these hires. And I hope that continues to happen. And we will continue to speak out about both of these guys. I hope that other organizations around the league are taking notice of this.
Yes. That's a good way of actually ending this on a high note. I agree with you. Let me just... I'm sitting upright because I'm getting excited now. You're absolutely right. You know what? The discourse has changed over the past decade plus. I mean, back in the day, it was all fanhood, men fanhood, rah, rah, rah. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter about rape accusation. Everyone's had a rape accusation, rah, rah, rah. You know what? Nowadays, that's not the same. We are seeing so many men step up and say, this is not okay. We actively need to speak out about this. That is a positive development. And you know what? You know what scares me just a little bit, though? Like, you and I just having this conversation, we are going to lose listeners who we've had for years just by having this conversation. And those people, those are the issues that I have with them. Those are the people that needs to be somewhat just removed from this entire conversation. Like, let's have more people get up on that platform, use the platform, and say, this is not okay by any stretch. And I also want to say, in football, soccer, this has also been an issue. Fanhood has been very, very vile for many, many years. But we're seeing a shift in that sport as well. There are harsher and harsher reactions to players who are racist or who have done something, like accused of rape, accused of spousal abuse, or any of these things. We are seeing a counter reaction now. And it sort of goes back to this ideology that was developed after the killing of George Floyd, or the murder of George Floyd, which was, it's not enough to be, against racist. You need to be aggressively anti-racist, for example. That we need to have the same opinion here, and more men do. And I think that is encouraging. I like that. It feels nice. I remember when you and I have talked about this so many times before, and we got called out on Twitter all the time. Like, oh, why are you guys focusing on that? Rah, rah, rah. Now we're not. Now we're hearing a lot more people, men, who actually said, oh, I'm so glad you brought this up, guys. Thank you. Which, dude, that's amazing. I mm-hmm. really like to see that development. That warms my heart, man. It's so nice to see that we are getting together on a higher level than before. And yeah, yes. there are still dirtbags out there who believe otherwise, but those voices just need to be drowned out.
Yep. Completely agree. All right. Well, let's wrap up on that note. Thank you, as always, for listening in today. Please follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bio, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some 5-star reviews. We're being hosted by Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. Until next time, I'm Brian Toporek, and I was joined, as always, by Morten Jensen. We have not forgotten, by the way, about the Bye Felicias for the second round. It's just been a lot of news to get through. So we will hopefully, barring any other blockbuster news over the next couple days, we will get to those probably next episode. But until then, have a good one, Mort.
You too, man. Later.